I'd like to ask you a question on this meditation. Like, from what I've read about Buddhist meditation, you're attempting to get mindfulness, which is emptying the mind, so that you're in a state where you're not getting any extraneous thoughts coming in.
Right.
Whereas, you know, when you read these type of books and you're talking about mantras and prayers, that's a total switch, because the mind is either full with the mantra or with the prayer.
Correct.
So what really are we attempting to do?
Okay, what we're attempting to do is to gain, through a process of stages, whether it be Buddhist meditation, Hindu meditation, Christian meditation, or Jewish meditation, it is all progressive. And so since you've brought up the correlation between Buddhist meditation, which is the modern approach and the modern understanding is to empty the mind, as opposed to the more Eastern Hindu version, is to fill the mind with something. Actually, we have to correct the traditional understanding. Both are attempting to empty the mind. The Vedas and the Upanishadic teaching of India, it's to empty the mind of impurity, darkness, and then fill it with illumination and the qualities of divine nature, with love, compassion, illuminant mind, a mind full of love. So let's compare by first talking about what the Buddha actually said in the Pali Canon when he told his followers to go meditate. If you read the Pali Canon, he spoke equally to the monks as to the householders. They had families. They were not intending to be monks. They were single people moving toward a family life. When he used the word meditate in Pali Canon, in the Pali language which the Buddha spoke, he said, go do jhana, as opposed to jhana, as it, don't misunderstand the terminology that's very close to it in Sanskrit, which is jhana. He's speaking of J-H-A-N-A. Go do jhana, as opposed to go do vipassana. Vipassana is insight meditation. The word vipassana means insight. And again, we have to discern between tradition and our modern approach. And this is the problem we all run into when we're trying to approach meditation that works, meditation that transforms. We have to be sure we're approaching the traditional method and not a modern terminology or a modern teaching, which is can be based on the scriptures and based on the Buddhist teaching and the teaching of Bhagavad Gita or the teaching of Jesus in the Bible or the Torahic teaching of, let's say, the Hasidic fathers. As time goes by, things change. God does not change. So the platform I want to use to answer your question is the traditional method. The word jhana, J-H-A-N-A, that the Buddha used means tranquility, as opposed to vipassana, which means insight. He would say, go do jhana, go do tranquility meditation, then after they became developed, then it was time to do vipassana, then it was time for illumination. This is exactly what, for instance, in the East, and Sri Ramana Maharshi said, the mind must become quiet. Now, there's a big difference here between quiet and empty. The Buddha is not saying empty the mind. He's saying make the mind still, make the mind tranquil, and in that state, then the Buddha nature unfolds, in a sense, naturally, without much further effort. So in the beginning stages of the tranquility meditation, there's a lot of effort. There's a lot of practice, and there are a lot of modes of practice. Even the Buddha, a lot of the Thai Buddhist fathers, as well as some Mahayana Buddhists, they're using a mantra, just simply the name of Buddha, which means they'll say Budho, Budho, Budho. That'll be the mantra they'll use. So what does the word Budho mean? It comes, of course, the Buddha's name came from that. It comes from a story when the Buddha was actually received his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. After that full enlightenment, he got up and started to walk. He started to just move. And there was someone who was close by and saw him. And he was in such a state of luminosity and wisdom and full of, not empty. He was full of compassion, fully awake. And so that person said to the Buddha, "What are you?" And the Buddha said, "Buddho," which means, "I am awake." And so the mantra the Buddhists use when they're saying Buddho, 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 they're saying awake, awake, awaken, awaken. What did Jesus say? You know, awaken. What did the Bhagavad Gita say? Become awake. And you do it first in that first stage of getting tranquil and still. Of course, Sri Ramana Maharshi, we're going to mix a lot of different paths here to try to answer the question.
Can I just, I'm compelled to
yes.
say something.
Good.
When you say the, use the word awakening, that's the sun Uranus, which is the planet of awakening.
Right.
And that's the ruling planet of Aquarius.
Yes.
So that is an awakening.
And for us, it is one of the most distant planets. In other words, it's what we need the most, and is when the earth, that is of the earth, earthly, we adopt the earthly mind to get along in life, you know, to be successful, to be courageous and, you know, withstand hardship, and also to gain material wants and mental needs. The Uranus is far off, that awakening. And so it's not out of our solar system. It is within our grasp, but it gets obscured. And this is why the process of meditation is the method to get this awakening. This is why even the Vedas say, and the Pali Canon, and the Bible says, you come to a point where the scriptures are no more use. You cannot get this tranquility by book learning. Yes, you can have aids, you can have books which will tell you methods of meditation and things to do. But ultimately, it's the practice and the tranquility of mind which comes first, and then the illumination. So we're after illumination. It's very interesting because the truth is, well, this example of the story I told about the name of the Buddha, in answer to the question, what are you? Who are you? The person who saw the Buddha moving as he got up away, he was so full and struck by the consciousness. It was anything but empty. It was so full. It was so awake. It was so full of compassion. So full of accomplishment. It was complete and perfect and pure. When we understand, we empty the mind. We're trying to empty the mind of impurity, of noise, basically thoughts. We're trying to still the thoughts. And when the thoughts become still, then there's a presence that's perceived. And as we embrace that presence being divine, and the Buddha did not at all take a stance of an agnostic stance. He was asked in many different places, what about anatta? What about not self? What about God? What about this divine consciousness? What about the fact that there is a self, a divine spark? That same divine consciousness moves from one incarnation to the next and is constantly evolving. That self, that Atman or Anatman, he never answered the question. You read the Pali Canons, you speak to the Buddhist masters, he never answered, because his purpose was to alleviate suffering, to get awakening, and to offer a path for awakening. So the Buddha is saying the path is first tranquility. Here you see a correlation between all of the paths that are present and known to us in the world. They're all saying, first we have to become quiet and tranquil. It's interesting, even Sri Ramana Maharshi, he was once asked the question, it comes in talks, He said, what is moksha? Moksha, that Hindu, this Sanskrit word, which means literally liberation and release, full awakening. He said, what is this full awakening? He quoted the Bible. He quoted Psalm 46. He said, be still and know that I am God. So he's saying the same thing. You must know you're God, but first you must be still. And this is a pure tradition of the Vedic understanding that the self, this divine nature, reveals itself. Ultimately, we can do nothing because it's an act of grace. So we're trying in meditation to become receptive to grace. And so we become quiet.
The Russian mystic Gurdjieff, I don't know if you've read it.
Yes.
His whole premise was, man is asleep and we need to wake up.
Yes, exactly. And so, let's try to move in a little to the practice, how it's done. First we should, in a sense, understand what the noise is that we're trying to quiet. And so basically it is thoughts. And thoughts, of course, come in different forms. And when you try to deal with them, they usually become more intense. And so the idea is, thoughts are either thoughts of the future in the form of imagination, memories about the past, or anxieties about the present. This is what fills the mind. It's either memory, anxiety, and stress, and imagination. So we'll start with the Buddha, since your question was centering around that. He proposed the Four Noble Truths. The first is the understanding, and you might say you comprehend the state there is suffering. This is the first noble truth. The comprehension there is suffering. Here again, we want to avoid what in our modern era it's becoming very popular, this what's called Neo-Advaitic school, where they say there is no suffering. There is no mind. It's all an illusion. We are that. And therefore, there's nothing that need be done. That is a particular aspect of a whole Upanishadic teaching, which is saying you must quiet the mind, you must have this tranquility, and then the illumination comes. Okay, so the first noble truth is comprehend suffering. And in the comprehension of the fact that there is suffering, the acknowledgement that it began somewhere. Okay. See, the purpose is to finally eliminate it, but you have to understand it began somewhere. Then the third noble truth, because suffering has a beginning, then it has an end. It's not eternal. It's not we're living, it's not hell. It's not everlasting damnation. Because it had a place where the inception of it, the end of it, is the third noble truth. And the fourth noble truth, which is the actual premise of the Buddha, after the comprehension there is suffering and the acknowledgement that it began, the understanding that it then therefore it can end, the fourth noble truth is develop the path toward bringing it to an end. So it's a practice. So the Buddhist practice was meditation. Now again, we're not just sitting and just trying to calm our mind and just watch it and let it go to sleep. Because now if we have understanding, which we're surrounded, of course, in this holy house by a lot of the Vedic teaching and the Bhagavad Gita, is the milk that was distilled from all the four Vedas. In the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna talks about, in the whole chapter 6 of the Gita deals with meditation. He says, there is internally this factory of noise, this entire like realm of thought that we find inside of our mind. It absolutely says, we have to understand, it is not an everlasting institution. Thoughts can come to an end. So here we're finding in Hinduism a direct correlation to the Four Noble Truths of the Buddha. There is a way to quiet the mind. And in quieting the mind, we're going to still these three aspects: the memory, the stress of the present consciousness, the present moment, and the worry of imagination. And you deal with it all with one method. There's not three different forms of meditation which deal with being consumed about and regretful about what happened in the past, or stressful about what's happening in the present, or completely like full of anxiety and worry about what's going to happen in the future. You deal with it all with one method. And the method is not dealing with the negativity of the three different modes of thought, but to infuse a positive, a divine element into it, and then it melts. The ego melts. The ego is this, you might say what the ego is, you might say defined as, it's this sense of individuality, false sense of individuality, that we are separate from that which is eternal, awake, and illumined. It's a false perception, but it is a living perception. It's very dynamic because we enthrone it, in a sense. We literally put it on an altar. And so when we decide to say, okay, we need to like dethrone the ego, well, it's gained strength over incarnations, and it's not easy. And so therefore, the practice must be as vigilant as the vigilance of the ego to sustain itself. And again, we're talking the ego, these negative traits, this field of thought which consumes us, it's constant and it's vigilant. So we must adopt an equally, or maybe even more powerful, vigilance in quieting it. So therefore, the first aspect of productive meditation is it must be persistent. It must be daily. It must be usually at the same time, and you don't skip it unless you're so sick. And then prayer enters in to say, forgive me, you know, and then you pray. So here again, the persistence that's talked about in the Bhagavad Gita is also found from the Pali Canon in the Buddha. The Buddha talked about the virtues. He said, you know, there's the Four Noble Truths, then there's the Eightfold Path. The highest virtue that the Buddha said, which is needed for successful meditation and transformation toward an illumination and awakening, is patient persistence. To be patient and persistence. To persist and don't worry. Why did he say this? He said this because he was aware in the 6 years that he struggled to find the end of suffering, he was considered the practitioner of the most austere methods. If you read the stories of the Buddha, he stopped eating. He stopped everything. He even tried to stop breathing. He became so weak that even when he had a call of nature, he would faint. Just from the action of that. This is all true. This is all history. He tried to like shut down everything, and it didn't work. And so he finally came upon the method of the internalization of the mind. Now, we're going to later on talk about the heart, because in the Bible, this is Easter, we should talk of the words of Jesus as well. What is hardness of heart? In our meditation, we are trying to remove, we're trying to soften hardness of heart. Okay? I'm going to describe it and try to define it. Then I'll get back to the method of meditation. In Exodus, the word hardness of heart is used 15 times. Throughout the Bible, it's used 52 times. It's there throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament. And if we look, try to get the traditional understanding and not our modern terminology, especially in the English language, we lose so much. As if you're studying Buddhism, you almost have to know some Pali to know the word the Buddha used and know its etymology, know what it meant. If you're trying to understand the Upanishadic teaching, you have to know or have to be told exactly the Sanskrit word that's being used in Bhagavad Gita or the Upanishad, and know what the etymology meaning is. In Christianity, the Greek thesaurus, in a sense, is considered, for us in the West, the most authoritative, because Jesus spoke the Aramaic language, and that's what's called a hieratic language, infused with spiritual, like, depth and symbolism. Then when it came from Aramaic into Hebrew, the symbolism was still there. The Hebrew language is full of symbolism and depth of understanding. The problem is we went from Hebrew to Greek. As you're talking about the apostles, many of them wrote in Hebrew. St. John the Apostle wrote originally in Greek. The Greek language is still an hieratic language. It's full of mystical understanding and multiple levels of meaning. Once it leaves the Greek language, it loses everything. When it goes to Latin, French, and finally English, it's almost destroyed. It's destroyed in a sense we replace it with something that's meaningful and help us in our struggle and our efforts to be spiritually alive and awake. But in the Greek etymological word, sclerokardia is the word used for hardness of heart. Sclerokardia, cardia and scleros. So when Jesus said, O ye of hardness of heart, and because of your hardness of heart, you don't understand. Because you're hard of heart, you don't understand the multiplication of the loaves. And what he's meaning is, the cardia, in the English understanding, and also coming from Sanskrit, we say cardia is heart. The etymological meaning is thoughts, feelings. Shlerok means rough, gross, insensitive. So hardness of heart means, if we're looking at the original meaning, it means a gross and insensitive mind. It's not the heart. It's not a center we say, okay, we think with our head and we have emotions with our heart. What the early biblical and the Upanishadic teaching is, we become dry. This comes from, literally, from the root word of scleros is kelo, which means to dry up. So that means we're doing something to dry up our mind, and it hardens our heart. I'm thinking almost immediately that wonderful phrase that Holy Mother Sri Saradevi said, who was the consort of Sri Ramakrishna, when she was talking, and she said, never criticize anyone, even someone who you fully believe they deserve it. Because criticism does two things. Criticism darkens the mind and hardens the heart. So the connection there. So this is criticism. And so it's the opposite of compassion. So the Buddha said, what we're trying to do is exercise compassion. So the practice of meditation, now we'll get back to it, is we're having compassion on ourselves. We're trying to reverse this dryness. Reverse this insensitivity and this grossness. Grossness to what? It's literally the word that Jesus used, insensitive to the divine. When Jesus literally in the Gospel of St. Mark is talking to his disciples about the characteristics of a hard heart and why we would want to soften it. Why we want to soften the heart. In Mark 8, 17 and 18, it says, when Jesus saith unto them, why reason? Why use your analytical mind? Why try to, through a psychological approach, why try to understand why the multiplication of the loaves and feeding the 5,000 occurred? He said, you neither perceive nor you understand because your heart is hardened. You have eyes and see not. You have ears and hear not. You do not remember. Really interesting. Again, this is coming from the early Greek Bible. So Jesus is saying symptoms of a hard heart, and therefore the reason why we want to soften it through the practice of meditation is we're unable to perceive the truth, the higher truth. We're unable to understand. We're literally unable to see or hear. We're unable to remember. And he's talking about inabilities in the spiritual realm, as meditation is in the spiritual realm. We're trying to remember. So we're not trying to empty out. We're trying to quiet so we can remember who we are. That's the purpose, to know who we are. Many methods, ways to do it. The Buddha said when he remembered who he was, he said, I am awake, meaning I am illumined. When Sri Ramana Maharshi knew who he was, I am the self. When that realization came, then what came along with it is the ability to perceive spiritual heights, to understand the spiritual implication of life and the spiritual purpose of life, to see the spiritual world, to hear heavenly things, and to remember who we are. So this is why we do it. So, yes, the first part of meditation is to empty out this, we've dulled our senses. Again, hardness of heart means dullness of mind. That's exactly what the Greek, when Jesus said, and even in the Old Testament, they're using the same word. It's out of that same Hebrew culture. It means dullness of mind. So we're not trying to empty the mind. We're trying to remove dullness of mind, the ability to perceive the truth. So in the Upanishadic teaching and the methods of meditation, we'll start to go through a few of them. Again, we're not trying to grapple with the negativity of our mind. Because we say, if we believe Sri Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, it's an enemy, it's a foe. As soon as you start to engage with it, in the terms of battle, it fights back. And we all know what happens when we sit in meditation and we try to quiet our mind. Sometimes it gets worse. You know, you can just sit and just kind of zone out and be kind of still. But when you close your eyes and you start to do a mantra, do Om, or do some name of God, or Buddha, or breath meditation, you're trying to focus on one thought as opposed to the multifarious thoughts of the mind. The mind ignites. Okay? So we have to understand, we don't want to deal with the negativity and say, why this thought? Why, no, I need to drive that thought out. What we're trying to do is infuse a divine quality on top of it. And this is how it melts. We melt it. We literally wear it down. We soften it. This is where Sri Ramana Maharshi said the quote in Padmalai, where he said, to know, K-N-O-W, to know the wondrous jnana vichara, to know the nature of God, it is only done by softening and melting within. And then he said, the great Yani, the great Vedantist, who said, it's only done by thinking of the feet of the Lord. Then he went on to say, and to finish the quote, without thinking of the feet of the Lord, the attachment of the I to the body will not cease to be. This is the ego. This is the power of the mind. It identifies with the body. These are all the thoughts we have. We very rarely in our meditation have a mind filled with divine thoughts. I mean, you know, usually it's the wrong stuff we're trying to eliminate. And so, why did Sri Ramana Maharshi say thinking of the feet of the Lord? It's a very important key. In our meditation, we're not trying to understand the negativity, sort it out. We're just going to focus on God, or we're going to focus on the name of God or some positive aspect of our nature. This is why affirmation is used in many forms of Western and Eastern meditation. You're affirming something positive. You're making a declaration. That in itself is because we have tremendous power. We have, since we're divine beings, we have divine qualities. The will of the human is powerful. If you, even if you don't believe it, or you don't even feel you can achieve an affirmation like, I am, give me an affirmation which anyone would like to have.
I am divine.
I am divine, right?
Peace.
Literally by the constant repetition of that, the mind starts to assume and understand it's true, and starts to like bring that presence into our conscious mind. And when that moves into us, what is not divine goes away. It melts. Now, of course, in the East, the rishis who really developed through eons the technique to do it, they thought, well, instead of saying, I am divine, why not just use the vak, use the power of speech to utter divinity? So here's where mantra came. Of course, they used om, the sacred syllable pranava. Later, other names of God came. So instead of saying, I am divine, I am divine, I am divine, which works, they'll say, om, om, om. That divine mantra, that sound formula, which manifests divinity. And this is the power of mantra, where if it's the name of God, we then look in the Bible, God and his name are one. So we're just putting into our mind a divine manifestation, not vibration only, just a divine manifestation. As it is vibrating in us, since we are literally beings of energy, above and beyond this physical realm is the mental realm. Above the mental realm is the pranic realm, the pranamaya kosha. We're beings of energy. As soon as we take the energy pattern of a divine name of God and start to fill our consciousness with it, it starts to rearrange, smooth out, melt, and transform our whole energy pattern right down to the cells of the body. Literally cells. This is why we find saints who are incorrupt. So many. Their physical body at death does not disintegrate. Paramahansa Yogananda, the great yogi, when he left his body in 1952, and they put him in Forest Lawn Mortuary, and the morticians said, we've never seen anything like this. For 21 days, his body did not even show even the slightest decomposition. It did not even lose body temperature. He was incorrupt. What it meant was that he had infused the divine vibration and the divine presence so fully, it had not only transformed his spirit and heart, it transformed every cell of his body. So not even the molecular cells were subject to corruption. This human body has this capacity. So we can literally, through meditation and the name of God, or affirmation to a much lesser degree, but still in that same direction, do that. Yes.
Let's take, for example, someone who doesn't meditate.
Right.
But who wants to overcome hardness of heart. And so they give up their life to a life of service.
Right.
You know, they might be missionaries or
do exactly.
Selfish acts. Isn't that also going to result in their ability to reach the stage?
Yes, it will. It will take, according to the masters of religion, a lot longer. But again, what you're saying is very true. If you have a propensity and your inner makeup is not prone to this inner practice of meditation, and you feel urge, compassion, and a need to be more externalized, you're still working on transformation and awakening and illumining. Sri Ramana Maharshi, in talks, said this exact thing, because he spoke about the three different methods. The question in talk number 27, we're talking about talks with Sri Ramana Maharshi. There's a series of questions, and I'll just give the answer pertaining to your question. First, he's asked, how should we discover the nature of the mind? How do we understand who we are, the ultimate cause, and then what is the art of eliminating the distractions of the mind and developing intuition? The question is asked, how is restlessness removed from the mind? He's describing different methods. Now, specifically to what you say, is talk 27, when he just says, how are they practiced? Because a person is saying, well, I don't feel inclined to meditation. Okay, how are they practiced? So here's the answer. I'll just kind of read it. An examination of the ethereal nature of external phenomena leads to vairagya. Vairagya means dispassion. We'll talk about that later. Hence, a method of inquiry or meditation is the first and foremost step taken. Now he's saying the first and foremost, meaning this is the quickest, this is the easiest, but he's going to acknowledge it's not for everybody. Okay. When this meditation becomes automatic, it results, and he uses the word, in a contempt for wealth, fame, ease, pleasure. Interesting. This is vairagya. This is the word in Sanskrit, which means dispassion, means you no longer want pleasure. Of course you don't want hardship. You say, whatever God brings. I just want to have a divine mind. So he's saying, this introspection and meditation is what it does, because when we meditate, and especially when, again, if we're using some method of meditation, let's say mantra or breath meditation, which is not a mantra, but it's just focusing, it quiets the mind and this divine nature starts to rise. As this starts to rise, literally this vairagya, this word of dispassion in the form of a contempt for wealth, for wanting this and that. I don't care if I'm poor, I don't desire to be rich, I just want to be. Meditation is one method, he says. Then he goes on to say, there are three different methods that this is done. Concentration is the key for all three methods. Development of concentration and awareness. The Noble Eightfold Path of the Buddha, right awareness is the first. Develop concentration. Whether we're going to be a meditative person, or we're going to be a social worker, or we're going to have a combination, we have to be concentrated and dedicated to what we want. When we say we want to be a teacher, we have to concentrate and dedicate and go for it. Same thing in meditation. So it's concentration. Okay, so we must become equipped with one of three different paths. The path of meditation, or the path of devotion, or the path of karma. So he's saying introspection toward the nature of the self, or introspection of the nature of God. You say, thou art my father, thou art my mother, I am thy child. That's the devotional path. As opposed to, you might say, I am divine. That is the purely, let's say, the Vedantic path. So you see the distinction between the two. Say, okay, I am divine, or I am a child of the divine. That's a separate path. Concentration is needed for all, for both. Or, he says, the path of karma. You're taking what he called the yoga marga, which is you dedicate yourself to the external for its upliftment, for its exercise compassion. In other words, you're doing things for others without the desire for the fruit. This is the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita. The fact that we say we do something without desiring the fruit of action. We renounce. So you see, all three, whether you're a social worker, a lover of that which is spiritual, or one who just wants to be just internalized, you concentrate on it and you become completely equipped with it through dedication. So here he's saying all three exist. The internal method of I am that, or I am a child of that. If you look at the scriptures of Hinduism, they'll say the devotional path is the safest path. Instead of saying, I am divine, because again, if we're talking about the Eastern Hindu Dharma, or Sanatana Dharma, God is very much the centerpiece. and not God externally. It's the presence of divinity. We're not saying it's an external God. We are part of that, but only a part. So we want to become whole. So they're saying the devotional path is the easiest because ultimately as humans, we want to be happy. We might say we might have great vairagya and dispassion, and I don't care if I'm happy. But there's something about securely happy, and because the Buddhist and Hindu and Judas and Christian, they're saying there's a direct correlation between a quiet, tranquil mind and a happy mind. In fact, the definition of a happy mind in Christianity, the early Christians and Hindu, is a quiet mind.
So if you look at all of the religions today and we put them in a pot, the thing they have in common is number two, devotion, because they're praying.
Right.
They're all praying in different languages,
exactly.
Different gods.
Exactly.
But that's the way they've designed it for them to get to enlightenment.
Right. And actually, when they say it was designed, if we look at Judaism, the Baal Shem Tov, the great light of Israel, he said, nothing exists without spiritual significance. Then the Hinduism, they'll say everything is inspired by God. The Buddha nature is what drives us toward nirvana.
Would you say that you could extend that devotional nature to a universal thought? In other words, for humanity and service to humanity?
Yes. What happens is this, and this is again how the Maharshi, Sri Ramana Maharshi, he said, the mind improves toward the accomplishment of either one of these three paths by practice. And what happens is they develop directly and then homogenize into one single method. So what happens is, yes, when you find someone who has reached or begins to reach the path of internal meditation or the path of, or to say, knowledge or jnana, or the path of devotion, they'll finally come upon what Sri Ramana Maharshi said, the greatest jnani, the greatest one who seeks knowledge of God, becomes the greatest lover of God. The one who seeks knowledge exclusively, when they reach it, or get close to that sun, and they get warmed by the truth of that, then they start to love it and adore it. In the approaching, you embrace it. And then when you start to embrace and love, then you see the world is full of that. There's nothing that is exempt from God, the spiritual nature. And then you love everything and you want to uplift it and serve it. This is the teaching of the Buddha. Compassion on mankind. This is why he came away from the Bodhi tree and spent another 45 years uplifting and teaching and moving to spread this. He was the greatest meditator. He had the most severe ascetic, and he could sit and meditate and go deep within and achieve this nirvana state. And in the achievement of that, what did his being assume? A drive to uplift the rest of the world. So here it is. The universal approach, you say, to universalize, it is, because the universe is all divine. So we seek it within, and when we start to catch it, then it literally drives us outward.
Let me ask you something also. The thought just occurred to me, talking about karma. Now, I don't want to personalize, but I, for one, I mean, I've been a teacher for 30 years and into metaphysics and so on, but to be perfectly honest, meditation, when I would bring this in my classroom, was never anything that I embraced. Now, I had been told on a karmic level that in another lifetime I was a monk. And the thought just crossed my mind that perhaps that's something that I brought with me, and that is why it's not something that I'm embracing in this lifetime. Because I've attained all of these things through
right.
My teaching, through life's teaching.
Yes.
And I don't say it egotistically, it just is.
Right. Well, it's very true that understanding that human life is seen through a succession of incarnations. It's very, very much like going through school.
Yes.
In one grade, you learn certain things, and then you kind of know it, and you move to the next, and you move up to the next grade, and then it's a little different. You're not abandoning the knowledge and the accomplishments that you achieved in an early one. You're just, the focus is different. But what you've said is perfect in the understanding that prayer and devotion never leaves you. Even though, say, in a life now that you might be dedicated to work, to healing, you're a healer, in your heart, that's the purpose of your life. And so you have a devotion to that, a drive to maintain it. Even though when you feel sick and flustered and all of the things, you push through it. Understand that that is an aspect of divine nature. Commitment and dedication. It's a divine nature. We never lose that. We never lose that affinity, even though we might be a great meditator and try to renounce the world. We end up getting close to and loving, and it'll drive us out. Or we go out and we serve the world. Then we start to embrace that divinity, and then it pulls us in. It's interesting, because the quality here is long-suffering. To be dedicated to a social service, or try to, in a sense, universalize your life, you have to be long-suffering. You have to be patient. This brings me to the remembrance of, this is Easter and biblical, kind of like the feeling is in the air. You know, in Exodus, when Moses was on Mount Sinai and he received the Ten Commandments and God was speaking to him, he said to the Lord, "I want to see you. Reveal yourself." And God said, "I can't. Because if I appear fully physically in front of you, you'll die." Like they said, they could not touch the Ark of the Covenant because the vibration was so concentrated, the human body just didn't have the kind of nervous system that could stand it. You'd just be overpowered and burned up. So God says, "You just can't." But God said, out of compassion, what I will do, I'll put you in the cleft of the rock. Here it is, this in the Bible. You face the cleft of the rock with your back toward me, and I'll just walk by. I'll manifest. It's almost exactly in, what is it, chapter, is it 15, 16, Bhagavad Gita, where the universal form, where Sri Krishna physically manifests, and then finally Arjuna said, no, take your human form, because I can't take it anymore. It's just so overwhelming. So God put Moses in the cleft of the rock, and God walked by. And so Moses feels what is called the wake of God, like a boat goes through water in the wake. And so Moses made the famous 10 utterances. How he tried to describe and verbalize his impression and his feeling and his consciousness as he's experiencing the wake of God. So he made 10 utterances. The first three are the most important. The first one was, all he could say was, "God." He couldn't even put an adjective to it. It was just, "Oh, God." And then the second utterance was, again, "God." Only after the third utterance was he able to collect his mind from just the overwhelming presence, even though he had his back toward it. And the third utterance, the first real description of Moses feeling the wake of God, was, "Long-suffering God." This is what, in our movement toward divinity, in our movement toward awakening, we manifest in ourselves these divine qualities. And so definitely, long-suffering. And, you know, for instance, I can tell you in my own life, lived in an ashram, in a monastery for 30 years, over 30 years, lived in India, living as a reclusive life, you don't develop too much long-suffering because you're isolated, you're reclusive, you're living, you know, like in a cave. And, you, of course, you have problems with, it's nothing at all as intense if you're in the world and you're trying to deal with people, especially if you're trying to uplift people. You have to be long-suffering, persistent in patience. This is why Moses felt this was the most dominant trait. If you want to say God has traits or personality trait, this was the first one he perceived. So this is the first one we need to perceive, and we all need to develop it. So definitely, if we're living a life and it's a very much dedicated meditative life, we need to get out a little and universalize it and try to move in the world, if for no other reason, to develop this long suffering. This is a divine quality.
It's a divine quality.
Moses is describing God.
It is a
divine quality. Long suffering. As opposed to irritation and I'm fed up, in the human realm, in the mental realm, there's an opposite. Shortness, you know, just irritation, just, you know, contempt. Oh, what happens when you're not long-suffering? Then you become angry.
And then, you don't develop the wisdom. You
right.
The wisdom,
exactly. Because what did Jesus say? Again, when he's talking about the hard-heartedness. You get a hard heart. You don't remember the wisdom. We, as divine nature, it's there. We just don't remember it. And this, again, in the chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita, where Sri Krishna, in two or three verses, he analyzes this whole mental problem that we have by saying, by attachment to objects comes desire. When desire is not attained, comes anger.
Right. Well, one of the definitions of anger is frustration.
Oh, yes. And again, we're talking about, if we're going to say, the not lose the thread of your original question, are we trying to empty the mind? Are we trying to quiet the mind? We're trying to achieve a tranquil mind. Anger is an intense vibration. Disruptive and destructive.
And toxic.
Very toxic. Poisonous. And the nature of poison is, again, when anger gets into your mind and poison comes, well, you might get over the anger, but the poison lingers. Who's being satisfied? Is it the individual I or is God, the divine nature? If it's divine nature, there's no satisfaction. God doesn't have any kind of motive.
Well, what other word could you use then, other than satisfaction?
Tranquility. Happiness.
Okay. Serenity. Peace.
Right. Okay. So I found the place. It's in chapter 2 of Bhagavad Gita. It starts with verse 62. Now we're talking about what happens to the mind. How we lose tranquility. How we lose the goal. How insidious the mind is. Okay. He'll start with Dayato Vishayam Punsham. Vishayam. Interesting, you use the word. Vishayam means poison. Vishayam. It means objects in the world, things we desire, provinces, fields. It just means the field of objects, you know, the world. Vishayam. Comes from the root visha, which means poison. It's poisonous. Now we can extract, we can develop our divine nature, and we can use it to purify ourselves, but if we use it wrong, it's going to poison us. So I'll just read the English. For a man dwelling on the objects of the senses, an attachment to them is born. We just dwell on them, we get attached to them. Okay. From attachment, desire is born. From desire, anger is born. See how the mind is now getting poisoned? You want it, you're not getting it, you get agitated. It's anger. It's interesting, you know, this is no small thing. In Hinduism, they say there's three gates of hell. Kama, Krodha, Lobha. Lust, greed. Yeah, we can say lust and greed are real gates to hell. The third one's anger. We get angry, we don't feel it's a big deal. We get lustful, yeah, we can feel it. We say, no, this is wrong. We get greedy, it kind of darkens our heart, hardens our heart. We get angry, it's just nature. I get angry, I got unjust, I get angry. It's still a gate to hell. And so Sri Krishna is emphasizing the fact that how this happens. Now, so from desire, anger is born. Now, he's even talking about desire that's being satisfied. Because it's like a fire. The satisfaction of it makes it enrage. Sri Ramana Maharshi said, it's like throwing gasoline on the desire. You get it, all you do is want more. There's two things that happen when you get what you want in life. The first is, the anger that comes and the stress from that anger with getting it. Once you get it, the stress and the terrific amount of energy that you have to employ to maintain it, to keep it from being taken away or lost or stolen or die. So, Sri Krishna says, from desire, anger is...
Ensure it.
Huh?
But ensure it.
You got to ensure it. You got to put it in a bank. You got to lock it up. You got to put a security system around it. You got to be thinking about it all the time when you go traveling. And you got to put a babysitter. And you got to, like, boy, you know. Then you, yeah.
Yes.
So the maintenance of it is probably more stressful than the acquisition of it. Okay. And then, of course, there's the jealousy because you got it, but next door they got it better. You know,
my
friend is a great teacher. I have no students. I got what I wanted. I have enough. But, you know, I want more. Okay, so from desire, anger is born. Now it really gets severe. From anger arises delusion. Again, what did Jesus say? This hardness of heart causes you to be forgetful. Sri Krishna is saying the same thing. Talking about, okay, why should we want to soften our heart? We want to not become dull and gross and forgetful of our divine nature. Again, we're talking about hard-hearted means dullness of mind, dried up mind. The Buddha said, the mind is everything. Sri Ramakrishna said the same thing. The mind is everything. It's not like it doesn't exist. It's the vehicle that we can perceive, approach, embrace, and adore that which is divine. And then finally see the affinity between that and us. But we have to touch it. We have to embrace it. We have to know it. We've forgotten the divine nature. That's why we need to meditate and go through all this practice in order to remember it. So from anger comes delusion. From delusion, memory wanders. Forgetfulness. From forgetfulness, intelligence is destroyed. Then, uninasat pranashyati. From a destroyed intelligence, from a dried up, hard-hearted mind, one is simply lost. And the word is lost. And you see, the word in Sanskrit is pranashyati, which means lost, destroyed. Comes from the root prana. The prana, the energy becomes so dissipated, you literally cannot retrieve it in that incarnation. Yes, you'll get another chance, another incarnation. But you never know if you're going to be even a human in the next incarnation, or a person who's even interested in any one of these three aspects, completely introspective and meditative, or devotional, or a karma yogi, or a person that's interested in social upliftment. You have no idea whether you can have interest like that at all.
You don't think that there's a choice?
You don't choose. Your actions, your karma, the nature of the state of your mind at the end, that determines. That determines. And that's why, going back to what you have said, which is so true, that's why all religions emphasize prayer and devotion. Because all this we're talking about accomplishment, it only comes through grace. So if we're throughout our life saying, be gracious, be gracious, be gracious, like Sri Ramana Maharshi, who was considered the greatest Vedantist and the greatest Advaitic Vedantas. Who promoted you are the self. He prayed to Arunachala, the sacred hill, and said, unless thou extendest thy hand in mercy and be gracious to me, I am lost. He's literally rephrasing the Bhagavad Gita. Talk about tradition. He was the embodiment of it. He said, now he who literally had that experience when he was 16 and then was the embodiment manifestation of pure self-awareness, pure awakening, pure illumination. He's weeping when he thinks about the saints and God, and he's saying to the sacred hill, which he considered an embodiment of Lord Shiva, he's saying, unless you extend your hand in mercy and save me, I'm lost. So you see, it's a real safety. It's a real safe way. That's why I say devotion is the safest way. Because you never know if you've accomplished the purpose of life. And you want to be able to, yes, move from one incarnation to the next and have it go always upward and higher and deeper and more awake. And so therefore that prayer, save me, have mercy, because it's all through grace. Even if we messed it up and we had more anger and lust and greed, and we kept walking into the gates of hell, yes, walking back out and sitting and meditating and being very nice and a real spiritual person, but getting angry a lot at the same time and being cruel, you know, these things, you know, we just end up, we don't know at the end where the balance of the scale is going to be. But if the prayer is there, well, God's going to have be gracious and overlook, literally, overlook and save us. Save us, say, yes, I'm going to save you from what you deserve. I'm going to wipe it away because that's what I do. I save. That's why Jesus was called the Savior. On this day, he rose from the dead to get us to rise from the dead. That's why the prayer in the Orthodox Church, they say, O Lord, rise in us. Cause us to have a resurrection. In both, I've seen this in both the Orthodox Church and in the Roman Catholic Church. They talk about the symbolism of the crucifixion. They say, we are crucified to the wood of the world with the five senses. The five nails that crucify us to the wood of the world are the five senses. Jesus overcame that. And he did it in all three ways. We're talking about the different, if we don't have the temperament. Now, I'm sorry, I told you at the beginning, I can go on for hours like this, so we have to probably quit somewhere along the line. Jesus did what you're saying. He universalized it to such an extent. What was Jesus? His mind was tranquil. He meditated. He was like, everything was like internalized. At the same time, he was full of love. He's called the Lord of Love. At the same time, did he not universalize it? Did he not travel throughout and uplift people to the point that he was literally crucified and put to death because of what he gave his life in that sense? So our resurrection, our Easter, our rising, is to literally rise above this world of the senses. And so we do it through meditation and some act and practice of devotion.
And how do you actually define devotion? Are you only focusing on the one area, or I'm a little confused.
Right. Devotion. How would you actually describe devotion? That means it's a movement of love. It's a movement of love. If you're devoted to work, you have to admire it, or else you just won't put forth the energy. If you want to move toward God, it has to be worthy. You have to consider it valuable. And also, devotion has the connotation that it is more than you possess, in the sense that I'm ready to dedicate. Devotion is also dedication. What is most marriage? I mean, it's like a compromise. you have to kind of like realize it's not all love. It's also it's a devotion in all its. You're devoted to getting along. You're devoted to sacrifice. You know, your wants for the want of another. You're willing to give up, you know, things. It's a mutual kind of a contract. So devotion, in a sense, is like a contract to God, with God. In the fact that we say, if I love you, really what the prayer is, make me love you. It's a petition. Devotion is a petition to God.
But and it doesn't only have to be a godly thing. It can be on a universal level.
Yes.
That's where I'm at.
It's a petition. You're saying to things on the worldly level, I'm willing to give myself. It's a sacrifice and it's a surrender. And it is the ultimate. And it's going to take everything. The Buddha went almost to the verge of death and then he got it. All the saints, they were really to give everything. This is why we meditate, to become receptive to the fact that devotion is a lifelong effort. Therefore, meditation at it should be a lifelong effort. And also, if we listen to the saints and the sages, they'll tell us, as all have said in all religions, this awakening, this illumination we speak of, this self-realization, because it is a self-realization and an awakening and illumination of that which is divine, God is infinite. The levels of awareness of it are also infinite. We can never say, I am that, finished. In fact, in modern understanding of some of the obscure Upanishads, people will say, I am that. Okay, I'm finished. I am that. They never said that. The Upanishads said, thou art that.
Well, there's constant challenges all the time,
right,
that make you go further into your world and to,
right,
you know, respond to it.
And this is why when we look at the incarnations of God, that's what they did. They constantly were like the Buddha for 45 years, didn't stop traveling. Jesus, to the cross, he gave everything.
I'm doing it,
and we're trying to...
Learning as well.
Learning, and we're trying to go deeper. And this is why we can gain a lot from external experience. But we even take that external experience and internalize it. This is why Sri Ramana Maharshi says, when he was quoting like from the Bhagavad Gita and saying, okay, from anger comes delusion, and this is all because of the attraction and the externalization toward objects of senses. He called that the outgoing mind. The practice of meditation is sitting and making the mind go in. It's an inward. It's an introspection. And so what Sri Ramana Maharshi said, as opposed to the outgoing mind, in meditation, the ingoing mind is called the heart-going mind. It's not a mind going in deeper. It goes to the heart. When we think of the nature of the heart, what do we say? The heart is full of what? We don't say the heart is full of intelligence. It's full of compassion. It's full of emotion and love. So devotion is, you see it through all religions. And therefore, may we be devoted. And may we, in all aspects of our life, this is why concentration, whether we are sitting and meditating and trying to shut the world out for a moment, or we're giving ourselves for some activity and we're trying to embrace the world, we do it with devotion and concentration and understanding that the purpose of it is for illumination of our divine nature. And that's why we do it. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
We didn't talk about the actual methods, and perhaps we'll do that on another day. We'll talk about, okay, what do you do? Why do you watch the breath? How do you actually focus? What do you do and how do you eat and how do you sit and where do you put your eyes and what level? We can talk about all, and we can restrict ourselves to that and just say, this is what you do, this is what you don't do, and you know, you don't cross your eyes, you don't look up at the third eye, you look at the tip of your nose, or you look here, and this is where you put your hands, and this, you put the right foot over the left, not left over. All these things are aids. So we can talk about that and really go into it. Okay, so may God bless us and keep us on this most holy of holies. Om.